Good afternoon to all. I'd like to call to order today's meeting for Chancellor's Church and the protocol involved with it. Angela, will you please take roll?
Chair Arriscada.
Here.
Regent Carballo.
Here.
Regent Downs.
Here.
Regent Goodman.
Here.
Regent Perkins.
Here.
You do have a quorum of the Regents Committee. President Zaragoza.
Here. President My name Achari. Is Clarissa.
President Acharya. President Helens. President Pollard. President Hilgerson.
Here.
President Whitfield. President Sandoval.
Here.
President Delphi.
Here.
Ms. Sherman.
Julian Smith as proxy.
Dr. Kruger. Mr. Seip. Dr. Bergeroy. Mr. Boog.
Here.
Dr. Kavanaugh. Dr. Montgomery. Dr. Marchand.
Present.
Mr. Strange. Ms. Anderson. Ms. Machado. Mr. Stamp. Ms. Espinoza. Ms. Bunta. Mr. Leon Martinez.
Present.
Ms. Thomas. Ms. Stanfield. Mr. Hahn. Ms. Stan Coutte. Ms. Olson.
Here.
Sorry. Mr. Daydon. Dr. Johnson.
Here.
Ms. McIntosh.
Here.
Dr. Miana.
Here.
That completes roll.
Thank you, Angela. Greatly appreciated. Now, prior to our meeting, I'd like to read the land acknowledgement on behalf of the Nevada System of Higher Education. Before beginning, we take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, the Washo, Numu, Northern Paiute, Nui, Western Shoshone, and Nuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign nations of Nevada. I'd like to also acknowledge Jeff Baker, the Chief Deputy Attorney with the Chief Deputy Attorney General, here to provide open meeting law and counsel to the committee. And we're going to start off with public comment. Is there public comment in Elko? Okay. Is there a public comment in Reno?
There is none.
Is there a public comment in Las Vegas? And there is none. So from there, I'm going to go move on to number two, please. Agenda item number two. And first and foremost, with everybody here today, I would like to thank all the participants. There's a lot on the line. There's many individuals that are going to be attending virtually. And as you heard the significantly stout introduction of all the individuals by Angela Palmer, this is going to be a committee for the ages. We're going to make sure we get this right. And unquestionably, we're going to put, and I am going to do all we can to make sure and to usher that the system is going to be in good hands for many years to come. But the Bryant Group has been selected to assist the committee and the Board of Regents in the search for our next chancellor. Headquartered in Incline Village, the Bryant Group is highly invested in the success and education in our state at every level. With us today at the podium is Dr. Bill Bryant, CEO, who will serve as the lead consultant for this search. Bill has almost 45 years of applied motivation and competency research with a focus on identification of factors that delineate top performing from average and poor leaders, which he has done in all major sectors, including education, business, military, nonprofit, and government. Also joining us today as an integral part of Bill's team and via Zoom is Nora Behrens. She's the program director with the Bryant Group. Nora is an integral part of the executive search team, which she specializes in project logistics, recruitment, and data analysis. This unique search process of the Bryant Group will provide a fresh approach to the selection of our next chancellor. But these approaches can best be described by one person, Dr. Bryant. And with that, Dr. Bryant, please take the lead.
Stay there.
Gotcha.
Okay, and you can also do me a favor, people whose name tags I can't see, if you would just slant them a bit towards me so I can respond appropriately. Thank you. Really pleased to be here. And this presentation is not for me, it's for you. And so I need to know your needs, not mine. I've already been hired. So we're in good shape from my perspective. Do me a favor, no more than 1 minute. Anybody, if you're online, you're here, just write down the two burning questions you have about this search that you want to be sure get answered before this presentation is over. Just a minute, two quick questions.
And with that, we're on the clock. We're going to go round robin for the attendees in the room today. Chancellor Boylan, or excuse me, Regent Boylan. I apologize. I'm
sorry. Don't apologize. I'll get that salary. I'll be happy. Is that the two questions?
Just one to start.
Just one, just now?
Yeah, we're just going to go right around quickly, just so that we get a tenor of the crowd.
All right. So, why were you hired to do this? How are you different from everybody else?
Okay.
Other companies, and how often have you done the search for a chancellor?
Okay.
That's three questions in one. I'm sorry, man. But I tried to sneak it in. All right. Thank you, sir.
Regent Perkins?
Actually, Regent Boylan stole some of my thunder there. That was the first question, why this particular company, and have you done such a professional search of this sort before?
Regent Goodman?
I'm listening right now. Thank you.
Regent Breger?
I have done three of these searches before for superintendents of the school district. What is your philosophy for in-state and out-of-state searches?
Dr. Mina?
Please define for us what you consider a successful recruitment strategy.
and Ms. Miyama. Ms. Cooper, I'm sorry.
Do you have experience incorporating soft skills into your list of desired qualities for candidates?
GSA President Thomas?
Same as Regent Brager, internal versus external, and then the timeline for the search as well.
Dr. Pollard.
How will you integrate competitive or compelling stakeholder views that are wonderfully diverse and sometimes not congruent in identifying candidates for the board to consider in hiring for this role?
And Mr. Weekly. Pleasure. And with that, Dr. Bryan, I'll propose to all Betty online if they have also additional questions. May they forward those over to you also?
Yes, and anytime, please.
Excellent.
Let me take some of the umbrella questions first and then go right into the process, if that's okay.
Maybe so bold and good. Quick interruption. Regent Brown, I overlooked you. I apologize, ma'am.
Oh, it's okay. Thank you so much. My question is, are you going to be implementing any type of blind search mechanisms during this process?
Can you explain that, please?
So earlier this week at the IDEA committee, we talked about, hiding certain parts of resumes during the initial, and I don't know if that works with the search or once it actually gets to the committee. That's what I was just clarifying, if it starts with your initial search or if it's only after it gets presented to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
And Regent Downs, my same apology for skipping over you, please.
No problem, thank you for the opportunity. How will this person integrate with the culture and community of Nevada?
Okay.
Thank you all, and ad hoc chair members. With that, if we can move onto item number three, the chance to search process. This is an integral part of the entire system. It's done in an introspective way, in a very intrinsic and holistic manner. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Bryan, please, it's on you.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to try to respond to these questions, if I forget any along the way, as part of describing the search process itself. In terms of why us, why different, you're going to see that as I go through this, and I will highlight the differences. I will highlight the diversity issues as well. You will find that the approach that we use is the only approach that I've ever seen that levels the playing field for all candidates. And I'll explain why that is. In terms of experience, we have no experience in higher ed. You're going, oh my God, right? The process that we use is highly agnostic in the sense that it's applicable everywhere. I used this technique when I was working with businesses and executives. And most of the time, the Fortune 500, I worked with a dozen, were asking me to teach them this methodology. So while I don't have a one-for-one on a chancellor, in reality, it really doesn't make a difference. In terms of disruption and why we're different, we look at ourselves as the Elon Musk of search. We're the disruptors through behavioral technology, as opposed to digital technology. We bring almost 45 years of competency, applied competency research and motivation research to the understanding of people and what makes for superstars. And there's a lot of consistency when you get up to the executive level of what that looks like. And to the question around that came up around soft skills. And I'll give you a couple examples of this when we get there in the search process. If you create a competency model, you compare two groups of people, let's say in the same school district or in the same corporate sphere, you know, all the marketing managers, things like that. And you study them with what is called the guided storytelling technique, which I'll describe in detail to you. What you will find when you get the model of the distinguishing factors, 8 out of 10 will always be soft skills. Technology, in some cases, when you study the superstars, is inversely related to success. Doesn't mean they don't need a baseline. But when you get up there, the higher you go, the more the role of an influence mindset is what makes a difference. So we're really looking for people at the end of the day, and this gets articulated in a lot of detail, who have the appropriate influence mindset. Have you heard of the Peter principle? You rise to your level of your incompetence, right? No modesty here. The Brian principle, and with a lot of information and research behind it, is that you rise to the level of your inability to influence. That's your ceiling. So what we are looking for is really effective influencers, but we have to detail that in terms of what types of roles and role proficiencies they can demonstrate, and what are the competencies, the knowledge, skills, talents, and so forth, that support their ability to demonstrate influence to do the roles really well. So I'll answer some of the other questions as we go. So let's just start at the top. There's the diagram you've got up there. I'm just going to go through quickly, so stop me if you have any particular questions. The first process is, number one, is setting criteria. And the criteria we're looking at, there are 4 kinds of criteria. And for those of you who are looking for something different, if you go out and you look at in searches you've done in the past or other search firms, you will find that criteria are not articulated. They're not detailed, they're not validated, and they're not measurable. We make all of that happen. And what we're doing that for are roles. What are the hats the chancellor has to wear on a regular basis and wear really well? What are the competencies that have to be demonstrated to wear to support those hats? And what are the leadership styles that are required to support competency demonstration and role demonstration as well? Now, another difference point is, beyond making all of those things detailed and measurable and validated, is that we look at what we call derailers, things that will knock people off the track. So what is it? And you could look, I'll ask you to look back in your history at some point to give us data on this. Are those particular attributes of a leader that will ensure failure here? And how do we measure them? And measure them before they get here. One of the things when you are interviewing people, no matter what interviewing technique you're using, they're not going to tell you how lousy they are. And they may have plenty of faults. So what you do, and through the guided storytelling, you're looking for omissions all the time. What aren't we hearing? But that doesn't tell you that they're a jerk on the job. And if we go back to this influence issue, which will become much more articulated as we move on, there are a lot more people with high influence needs who are jerks than people who are high in influence with social conscience. And those are a couple of the factors that you have to keep in mind. So the first thing is criteria. And when we get down to the leadership profile, we'll give you some examples of that. So we're very different here in terms of the detail, the measurability, the validity, and the fact that we measure those things that they're not doing well. Now, part of that is that most reference checks aren't done well. We do really thorough reference checks, and we use storytelling as part of the reference checking process. That's where you will find out some of these derailers, these failure factors. So if you shortcut the reference process, and in some cases, and it just depends on how deep you want to go, we don't just do current references and checks. We're always talking with people who are not recommended by the candidate. And often we will go back two or three jobs to get that information. So that's the first step. Any questions around criteria? We'll look at it even more on the next as we go.
I don't believe so.
Okay. We then create from the criteria a standard evaluation form that is used with every single screening process that you use, applications and so forth. So if we go to the next step, which is the application stage, we will be screening those. And it is our understanding at this point in time, and Chair can correct me, but that's going to be our job.
Yes and yes. So we're going to do this collaborative effort in which we'll be working together, yes.
Right, right.
Which is in
And application screening for us is very extensive. It can take at least 2 hours in many cases, sometimes more, to screen an application. We have an 8-page guide for screening applications. How do you distill from an application role proficiency, competency proficiency, leadership style proficiency, and any hints of failure factors? Once we've done the applications, we're looking for maybe 8 to 10, depending on how many candidates we have at that point in time, for what we call short interviews. Now, our short interviews are 2 hours long, at least. And in that, there's sort of a standard piece to it, because the only thing we've seen so far is the application. Although we may have called people on the phone to fill in the blanks, you didn't send this in, so forth and so on. The first half of it is storytelling, which we're getting to. And the second half is more standard questions, like you've looked at the application. There's a 2 or 3 year gap in there on the resume. Please fill that in for us. What were you doing? So forth and so on. So it's pretty straightforward, pretty straightforward. The storytelling is, and let's go ahead. Well, I'll come back to the storytelling. Let's get through all the steps first. After the short interview, we boil it down from the 8 to 10 to 4 or 5. And we're saying, let's take a look at these in real depth. And the real depth is an interview that lasts about 4 hours. We always record them in case you want to go back, because remember, we've created this scoring form against all those standards, those four different types of standards. We want to be able to, on every screening we're using for standards and consistency, make sure that, in fact, we are removing bias from the process. We're using the data. We're using the behavioral descriptors of the different categories of criteria. So to go back, because we're getting to the point now to respond to the diversity issue, and being the only firm that does this, is that if you don't have criteria at the level we're talking about, immediately personal bias comes in. I love the way she does her hair. He really, dresses well. My gut tells me, guess what? Your gut's wrong more than it's right when it comes to evaluation and candidates. The only thing that keeps you and levels the playing field is all of you being able to say, did we in fact see these behaviors, thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that we have come up with as criteria in the stories, in the applications, in everything that we're doing? And you have to provide evidence. You can't just say, well, I think so-and-so demonstrated initiative. No. If initiative is one of your competencies, which of the behavioral indicators were demonstrated in that story? Absolutely levels the playing field right off the bat. Because some people aren't as polished, don't have the same background, don't have the same language skills, but they can be darn competent. And we measure that. When we get to the interview, once again, people are really different. You can have people that are very verbal, tell all sorts of things. They look good, they sound good, but can be an empty suit. The only way you find that out is through storytelling. Because if you ask traditional interview questions like, you know, what are your skills? What are you good at? What will people say about you? Where do you want to be in 5 years? Zero predictive validity as to what they will show in the future. None. I'm familiar with and been trained in just about every interview technique, starting with critical incident interviewing, appreciative inquiry, behavioral event interviewing, behavioral interviewing, and so forth. The only thing that gets you there is storytelling, and it can't be faked.
Dr. Bryan?
Yes.
Question, sir. What makes your unique process head and shoulders or different from other search consultants? How has your process become so successful in the past?
Because of the rigor and the behavioral science behind it. Nobody does the rigorous criteria. Nobody does four types of criteria. Nobody uses guided storytelling. We have 100% search rate. We've only been in business 4 years purely for search in the ed sector, but we have 100% success. The other thing that comes out of this is where part of the success comes in, that people don't have selection remorse after the fact. You have much less conflict within the search committee because you're following standards and you're demanding people follow those standards.
Question for you, sir.
Yep.
Regent Brooks.
Thank you. Byron Brooks for the record. I just have a couple of quick ones, and I wanted to be able to hit on them as you're moving through the process so that I don't
sure.
Lose time in terms of.
Yep.
So the first was the two-hour screening process of each application. I would imagine is the time that you're taking to go through the diligence of whatever the application looks like, making sure it's been filled out correctly. We've
screened the applications. Say we've got 20, and we bring it down to 7, 8, or 9, something like that, and then we do the short interview.
Gotcha. So the screening of the applications in total. In terms of the application itself for the applicant, what I didn't hear was any in-depth of background that you go through in terms of the candidate.
There's no background checking until they make finalist status.
So when you, again, Byron Bush for the record, so when you make the final assessment of those that you classify as candidates that you want to move forward, at that point then you're doing a background search or investigation on those select candidates.
After you've done the application, the short interview, the long 4-hour interview, and then you're saying, who's remaining? Usually it's 3 or 4. And one of the reasons you can't do any background checking before then is that you expose candidates. At least half your candidates may not want people to know that they're applying.
Sure.
And on an ethical side is we just don't feel it's right to jump into people's lives and backgrounds until they're agreeing that, yes, I want to be a finalist. I'm going to let the people know in my home university or whatever system they're in that I'm ready to go.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. And then when you spoke about behavior analysis and behavioral science, can you share with us what your specific background is in behavioral analysis?
Sure. I started out as a military officer, so as a leader, you're always, you know, looking at your troops. You know, who's got it, who doesn't. But then when I got out of the service, I got a doctorate in clinical psychology from George Washington University with a focus on families and children. And I was in that for about 9 years and then made a switch to business. And that switch was very fortunate because I was hired by one of the top competency and motivation researchers in the world. And that was David McClelland, who was the head of the psych department at Harvard. And I went to work for him and his consulting group. And he had already, I'm standing on his shoulders in many ways, many decades later, but he had already started a different type of interviewing technique and the ability to assess both motivation and competence in a very concrete way.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah.
Pleasure. Dr. Bryan, what step were we looking on?
Okay, so we've gone through the long interview. And that's where we sit down and we've put together a package for the chair to look forward, to look through. And the chair says, you know, these two or three look like they should be finalists. We should bring them in for the next stage, which is the meet and greet, the forums, Reno, Las Vegas, and so forth. So this is where you and the public get a chance to see this person in action, whether they're face-to-face or people are watching online on some of the forums. Any questions before we move from there?
Questions from the search committee? President Pollard?
Thank you. I'd love to, if we could step back to the top of the process. I'm interested to hear, and I think it amplifies one of the questions previously articulated, how you will go about recruiting potential candidates for the search itself. My rationale falls in two places for that. One is that there are probably about a dozen well-known search firms as it relates to higher education. Mm-hmm. So you're stepping into a space that's fairly new for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that means something to potential candidates. So I'm interested to know how you will delve into that space thoughtfully. And then also, well, maybe I'll just stop there. That is a particular interest to me.
We use the same tools that other search firms do in terms of getting the word out. So we're you know, from the more broad things like Indeed, but to the very specific, like Hispanic higher ed, publications and putting, you know, information into those and Black and you name it. There's probably two dozen different organizations that we will put advertisements in. That's one thing. The other thing is keep in mind that every single person here and online is a recruiter. We will be providing you with tools and we give you a 2-page brochure to kick that off. Send this to everybody you know. Let's get out there. You know people that we certainly don't. Now, one of the ways we do that is we say, if you know somebody, let us know, and we will call and recruit them if you think they're good. The other thing we're doing is headhunting. You know, we've got a lot of passive candidates who are not applying. So we will try to get input from you and our own research to say, who should we be calling? And we will call them and see if we can induce them to apply. When people are applying, one of the things that we give that other search firms do not is that we offer to people who make it to semi-finalist and finalist but don't get chosen, we do a professional development follow-up with them. We don't put you in legal liability of saying, well, you got these points, the other person got these points, that sort of thing. But by telling them, walking them through the criteria, letting them know how they can strengthen their position for the future and strengthen their practice as a leader. For many, that's a very positive inducement to stay in the game or be in the game if they're wondering whether they want to apply.
And an advertising plan will be presented during our next meeting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Regent Perkins?
Okay. Have you dealt with, I guess I didn't hear it in your brief there.
Sure.
About complying with open meeting law while we're doing this recruitment.
Say it one more time.
Complying with open meeting law while we're doing this
recruitment. Oh, yeah. Particularly difficult in Nevada. They've got the strictest law anywhere. And I'm almost going to throw that back at the chair or Carrie to respond. We had to work this through in Washoe. We just finished the Washoe superintendent search. And we did a workaround because my concern, particularly in getting the criteria in the beginning, is that you're hearing all the voices. And it's always a stretch if you're, you know, with the open meeting law, because if you need people to look at candidate materials to give you input, but the candidates can't be exposed. So that becomes a real problem. And I can tell you, having tried it before, you know, you redact stuff from their materials, it doesn't work. People figure it out. It's almost impossible. The workaround that we did there, I'm not suggesting it here at all, is that we created the Bryan Group Search Committee. And because it had no link to the formal board in Washoe, we could do whatever we wanted. And we put out a survey, and we had well over 370 people say, we want to be on your search committee. And we selected about 30. But It's difficult. It's hard to do. We had a legal challenge to it, which we won. So you've got to keep your eyes open. It does put handcuffs on personnel issues.
And also, I'll divert the question over to DAG Representative Becker. Excuse me, sir.
It seems like the wisest choice going forward is to stay in touch with Chief Dag Wilsley Bordelove, who's already working with the board. So as the procedure goes forward, you can check step by step with the AGO in terms of, this is what we want to do. Does it vibe with OML? If not, how can we adjust it?
Yeah.
I like your idea of a separate committee that's not board, that's not government elected or appointed, that kind of stays out of OML. But then again, when you take that and apply it in the actual open meeting, there might be some tension there.
Yeah.
So before things are put on paper and finalized, they should definitely check with the AGO and especially Chief Dag Bordelove.
Yeah, yeah. Understood.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Dr. Baker, Dr. Bryan, if we could, please. Can you go ahead and give us a little bit more background on the supplemental material of the guided storytelling interviews?
Sure. It's a really interesting process. It's very hard to learn. When we do workshops and train people on it, it typically will take anywhere from 3 to 5 days to get somebody up to a 70 to 80% level of proficiency. If you have had a counseling background or psychology background or whatever the case may be, it often takes those folks twice as long because they already have set patterns of making assumptions and asking questions that get in the way of getting data. And past performance is the only real predictor of future performance. So what you're doing, and let me just talk you through what the opening is to a guided storytelling interview. And keep in mind that the interviewer cannot lead at all, cannot put words in their mouth, but can only guide them with the simple questions of, what did you do? What did you think? What did you say? What did you feel? Recreate the conversation. And that's about it. That's about it. So the intro goes as follows. You've got to speak in the first person. That's we set up the rules for the interviewee right in the front. You have to speak in the first person because you say, you may be a great team player, but you say, we did this. We don't know who the agent is. Did you do that or did somebody else? So they have to be speaking in their own words. You tell them they're going to be frequently interrupted. They may only say half a sentence. You say, stop. I'll give you an example. Let's say that someone is university president, is in fact looking to get approval from the board for a $5 million program, looking for funding, and they put together a package. They're going to come in and give a pitch. And so they're telling me the story, and I've asked a lot of, you know, probed a lot up until then. They said, well, I was walking in the door back here and had my pitch ready to go, and I go back, wait a minute. You say you walked in the door. What were you feeling? What do you mean, what was you feeling? What were you feeling when you walked in the door? Well, I was kind of nervous, but I knew that I had done my homework. You say you did your homework. What did you do? Describe it for me. What did you see? What happened next? Okay, keep going. I walked in the room and, well, in this room it would be different because they'd be at this podium. But in most cases, people on a board or around, more of a board table, circular, whatever. The person who isn't influence-oriented will say something like, what do you mean? I just, opened the door, I walked in, I saw it was an empty seat, and I sat down. I had my paperwork with me, I was ready to go. A high-influence person would say, I opened the door, I looked around and said, whoa. There are two or three people at this meeting that I didn't know was going to be there, and I'm not prepped for them. How do I figure out what their needs are? How do I respond to them well in that meeting to get what I need? Because I couldn't do my homework around them before I walked in. The high-influence person will also say, which chair do I take if I'm going to be sitting at a table? Because it matters who I'm sitting next to, that maybe I can grab their ear. Very, very different in terms of the competencies, but you only get it. You only get the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors if they're telling stories. Now, the other part of this, in terms of getting to stories that make a difference, and what's interesting, fascinating here is, it's content-free from the interviewer's point of view. We don't care what the story is, because competence travels. If you show initiative, and if that's one of the competencies you're looking for, in one story, even if it's a down story, we get down stories and up stories, you should see it in other stories. And if you don't, you know it's weaker than you would want it to be. So to get back to the protocol, so talk in the first person. I'm going to interrupt you frequently. Don't be offended. When people see this the first time, they go, oh, my God, how can they sit there and be peppered by all those questions? But it's not content questions. It's just saying, what did you think? What did you do? What did you say? What did you see? Then you also give them guidance. If you give me anything that's an L-Y word, occasionally, typically, basically, usually, that's not good enough. Usually we do this. Basically we do this. No. Drill down. Give me a concrete example. Talk me through it. There has to be data, something that really happened behind it. Usually ask for two or three ups and downs. Why do we get ups and downs? Well, all of you can relate to this. The research says that anything that has an emotional valence or weight to it will be remembered in much more detail. So, where were you when the Challenger blew up or the, Twin Towers came down? You can probably remember, while I was sitting here, I was looking at this, I was doing this, or the birth of your first child. You can describe it in terrific detail. So ups and downs are critical for the emotional component that builds that hologram in your brain, and the better the hologram, more inputs to it, more intense, the better you remember it. Some cases you will tell them, don't be offended, but I may cut you off in your story and we'll move to another one. When you've seen a couple stories and you're not seeing anything new, you move on to a different story. Once again, they pick the content. To kick off the process, what you do is you say, you describe what an up or down, and by the way, up or down, and you make sure that it makes sense. Up story doesn't mean that you won the Nobel Prize and were on the, you know, front of the Los Angeles Times. It's just something that stuck with you that as you remember it, gives you a glow. You feel good. You can remember it in pretty good detail. A down event doesn't have to be an abject failure by any means. It's just something that has stuck with you. You know, I didn't get the outcome. Took too long. Went over budget. Maybe something that you had a chance to do a do-over, you would do a do-over. That's what we mean by an up or a down. So it's very personalized, very personalized. To kick off a storytelling, what they have to do is they say, Bill, okay, I've got an up story or I've got a down story. And that's fine. Okay, what is it? And then you say, give me just the paragraph of framing what that story is about. Well, this story was about when I went to the board asking for $5 million and I got it. Okay, I understand. Up story, this is the context, makes sense. But I also need to know what's the time frame. Did this happen over 2 years, 2 months, 2 days? And that helps me as an interviewer understand how to fast forward, where the focus is going to be. And if it's a long story, there are going to be many stories in the story. And you have to, as an interviewer, pick out which are the most salient ones within those groups of stories.
Dr. Brian, question, sir?
Yes.
Is on the guided storytelling interview, the next one, method-based, it's research method-based, dating all the way back to 1950s. But the technique of the overview is what you were just describing about there's going to be frequent interruptions and other uniquities to the entire interview process. What is the, are there, and I don't want to let you share your trade secrets. However, do you have certain questions that you know that's the good candidate, that is a candidate that'll be subpar? Or is it the interview, is it the person by themselves, the holistic, full person?
It's full person because how we know it's a good interview is we've got the criteria in front of us.
Okay.
You know, these are checking off, bang, bang, bang. I'm hearing concern for influence. I'm hearing resilience. I'm hearing critical thinking. And we can score it against the criteria. Or on the roles, you know, good negotiator, good mediator. Are these tasks getting done at a high level? So it jumps off the page. We do not ask specific questions that are content-based during that part of the interview. We do ask some follow-up questions. What's interesting about this is, let's say you've gone through a whole interview, and there's other sections of the interview that give you data and validate what you hear in the stories. But at the end of the day, and what we do is we take breaks during these interviews. People who are listening to the interview, after a couple sections, we say, stop. What have we heard so far? You know, what do we got to get our antenna up? Let's say team building was really critical competency, and you haven't heard a darn thing about team building. None of the measurables that you have identified are there. And so you say, well, let's, as we go back to the next section of the interview, next couple stories, for example, let's keep our ears up. But you can't direct the person to tell you about team building until the end. And then if at the end you still have a gap, you haven't seen what you're looking for, you lead the horse to water. And you say, hey, Joe, one of the things we know in this particular position is that team building, particularly looking to the future to help us meet our goals, carry out our mission, whatever the case may be, is going to be critical. Do you happen to have an up or down story around team building? So we've really led them to the water. And it's fascinating. If the interviewer has done a good job and you haven't heard team building, it's probably not there. And when they try to tell you a team building story, sometimes what they'll say is, I really don't have one. or they'll give you a story that really doesn't have much to do with team building. So you've validated the fact that the gaps that are there. Now, sometimes people are saying, well, what about EEO concerns? And you're not asking the same questions. We are asking the same questions. They create the content and the story, and the process is exactly the same for every candidate. And it's so much more effective than traditional stuff. We haven't really discussed this, but I think panel interviews are a total waste of time. It doesn't give you quality data. You're having to use fixed questions that don't get at who the person really is. Now, if you have to do it, I will give you some suggestions on how to do it. And it goes back to what Sherm professes is a great way of interviewing, which is behavioral interviewing. A lot better than traditional. But that's setup interviewing. You're giving people the content. See, the issue here on storytelling is they pick what's front of mind for them and what's important for them. That's where the stories come from. That's where they put their energy. And if you direct them to things that they could care less about, plus you can go on the Sherm website and see the 35 most typical behavioral questions. Tell me about a time you had a conflict with your boss. Tell me about it. Well, they can tell you about it, but because you let them there, and the fact that nobody uses the depth of interviewing and probing technique, you're not going to get good data. The predictable, you know, the ability to understand scalability of what they can do and whether they will in fact do it in the future is most of the time is totally missing. You can feel good about it, but that doesn't mean you're going to get good results.
Thank you. Throw this out there. Any questions to the ad hoc board members? Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. You just said team building. Are you referring to that as leadership? And does the leader know how to build the team? You were in the military, like you said, and you were an officer, so you know.
Yeah.
And you know when to cut people out also. How would you judge that this person can build a team and also not destroy the team, but cut out people that you
just a side comment, Regent Boylan. You know, a lousy leader can destroy an organization in 3 to 6 months, and it'll take you 3 to 6 years to bring it back. So you better understand who you're picking, right? The issue here is that if you have created the criteria, and we only, if you look at the criteria that we have, whether it's role and competency in particular, and you look at the measures of that, that needs half, at least half those measures need to come from you, not me. I've got a research library of all the ways people have demonstrated in leadership roles of team building. But that doesn't mean that those are the right ones. Team building for this organization with the cabinet or whatever the case may be is going to look very different than the organization in the other state. In the 40 plus years that I've done this sort of work, I have never created two sets of performance criteria that were the same. Never. Even though you might think it's the same, or it's like two school districts side by side, they're never totally the same. Maybe 50%, but even at that, because you have to capture in the criteria the needs, the culture, all of the things that make a difference about being a good fit as a leader in that position and in that particular context.
Please, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Chair. Now, you said some nice things, but when you, the last thing you said, a good fit, sometimes that's really, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, this is the same culture. I don't like that. I mean, can you change the culture? Can you lead and make things different? Can you be the person who isn't trying to have everybody love them, but you're there to do a job?
Yeah.
You know, you've got someone who can rock the boat. That's what I'm talking about, someone who isn't afraid of change, but at the same time isn't afraid of admitting what they don't know and how they can change.
Well, I think the issue there is,
yes, sir.
How do we make sure that that information gets to us to build it, build into the criteria so we can measure it? And that's the challenge of the search committee, to make sure we get that level of detail.
Thank you, Regent Bullitt. Yes.
So this process seems quite unique, and I imagine that a number of the candidates may not have encountered an interview process like this before. I'm just wondering if you're confident that this process doesn't bias toward people who are uncomfortable with the process. You know what I mean?
It's rare, actually, once you start the storytelling, that after the first story, people aren't sort of into it. The common response afterwards was, I'm exhausted, but I really learned something about myself. Thank you. People who get really uncomfortable, they tend to get comfortable because when you're probing, it reveals that they don't have competence. And you want to know that. And sometimes reading their discomfort is part of the process. And the other thing that may sound strange about this is, but I have coached people before going into an interview like this. And you'll say, well, aren't you giving away the farm? No. You are who you are. When you tell those stories, it doesn't matter what the coaching was. I can remember when I was with the Harvard group to start with, part of the exercises were, write a story that has these mindsets and these competencies in it and take as long as you want. And even when you knew, you know, what your mindsets and competencies and role proficiencies were, that you couldn't write a story nearly as well as the person who that was natural to. You just couldn't make it up. And even with a lot of sophistication. So from a, you know, can you fake it point of view, it's really hard. I mean, you might get a really bright psychopath in there. But then the consistency from one story to the next, to the next, to the next, isn't there. And you're looking for how those traits and competencies travel. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Krug. Excuse me, Dr. Bryant, and thank you, Dr. Krueger. Yes, sir, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, sir, because that helps what I had in my mind, because you talked about telling a story and writing an essay. And I had this in my mind, that could we write an essay with the words integrity and empathy and confidence in there? That's what I was thinking. That's the kind of person that I would be looking for. Somebody with empathy but confidence,
mm-hmm.
and then integrity to the utmost. Yeah. I don't want the tail wagging the dog.
Understood.
Yeah. So I want someone, that's my opinion about a leader and who would fit well.
Well, once again, the key point here is for us to, when you look at the criteria, the roles, the competencies, leadership style, and failure factors, and you read how we're going to measure it, that, you know, just nails it for you. It says, yeah, if we see these things in their stories and in their behavior and in the interviews and in their application, then I'm comfortable they've got the right stuff. So the thing that's crazy and differentiates us is that I don't know of any other firm out there that sets criteria. And that's the cornerstone. Finding people is the easy side. You may not believe it. Oh, we've got to get somebody who's done 1,000 searches with higher ed. No. If you haven't got the criteria and not using the guided storytelling, who cares? Because you don't know what you're measuring. And you're not going to measure it in an unbiased, even-handed way. And remember, experience and charisma are rarely associated with competence. You can have a ton of experience, but do the same thing lousy year after year. That's not what this is about, or shouldn't be about.
And on that statement, we're going to take a 10-minute break. Thank you, sir. We'll see you in just a few minutes.
Okay.
We're going to come back now from the 10-minute break. We're going to slide into item number 4, the Chancellor Leadership Profile for information only. Dr. Bryan? Actually, sir, if I may take some liberty.
Sure.
Some of the supplemental material that you provided, in which I want to just make vast acknowledgement that we fully recognize that it was previously utilized if I remember correctly, from a recruitment document provided to the applicants during your previous searches. But we, at least the search committee, myself, we unquestionably need to update the document so that you, the Bryan Group, can utilize this new document to develop additional materials for the search.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Excellent. Agreed. Yeah.
And of course, the staff will update the sections titled Settings and Demographics. And I'm imploring all the presidents of each institution, to update the sections to Chief of Staff Nikolajewski by next Friday, February 10th. And President Pollard, since you're the lone one here, you're hearing it. Thank you much, ma'am. I appreciate it. Dr. Bryan, please continue.
Okay. And as you all know, we were only knew that we were selected Friday, so some of the, we haven't had much time since to tailor these things, but we will. So we're moving into the leadership profile. And in reality, you have four profiles. The first profile is the one that's come out of the office that gives background and lots of information and so forth and some statements of selection criteria. But when we have the selection criteria, we will be significantly beefing up that and also increasing its marketability in terms of how it looks. The second thing that will spin right out of that as we're doing this is the two-page brochure that we want everybody to start using and send to friends internationally, wherever, you know. But primarily our focus initially is here in Nevada. But make sure that everybody gets to see it. And then the third one are the criteria we're going to be talking about here, the ones that really make a difference, the measurable ones, the detailed, validated, measurable criteria, so that we know what we've got in front of us. And the fourth one is we'll be creating an updated position description for the position that incorporates those highly specific criteria. So all of those things are happening and all can be labeled as leader criteria. But let's start first with a little background information, which is on the screen. Out of all of these decades of competency research, when you're up there looking at what, you know, who's a superstar, who's average, who's poor, what's the difference? And by the way, one of the fascinating things about this is that from a research point of view, it's very well accepted and studied that nominations of superstars usually get 90 to 95% reliability. And that's the basis of the research. So if I'm in a company or an education organization and we actually want to do seminal research, I say, give me, you know, 20 superstars in that position and give me 20 average. Don't tell me who. But those nominations really do work out amazingly well. And after you've done guided storytelling and transcripts and scored them and everything else, and you pull them apart, you will see instantly that the superstars are demonstrating many more competencies, many more role proficiencies, better leadership style, and less potential derailers. So after all the research, I found that there are sort of 11 buckets you can see on the screen that abilities and characteristics and attributes fall into. The key thing to keep in mind here is that you, as you move from left to right, you go from what I call sociogenic to biogenic, more DNA personality based. And probably no surprise to you, and kind of goes back to Dr. Kruger's question, that the success factors are primarily in that far right column, with the exception of physical characteristics. Motivators, drivers, traits, aptitudes are the things that when we start creating criteria, you will find them falling into that category. So one of the things that we do that's also unique is that we identify what are the mindsets are mental drivers for the types of attributes that we're going to be using. And we can assign a, quote, trainability. In other words, level of effort to acquire or to enhance. And that's critical. So if you had 20 competencies and you all saw them all being really critical, let's say team building is critical, but team building has a trainability to it. Political savvy always comes out for an organization like this, right? That really falls into the influence category that is very hard to train. Now, is DNA destiny? No, DNA is not destiny. But if you don't have some of these things to start with, the training and development has to start a lot earlier. And brain plasticity is there, something I'm interested in. And I know you can actually increase brain mass in certain areas, but in some cases, it takes a lot of time. A lot of time. And you, on things that are critical, you don't have time for that. So if you've got, they've got 19 of those things and they don't have political savvy and that's critical for the job, you don't hire them. So one of the things we'll do is we will look at all of the criteria and you have to come to a decision which of these are deal breakers or not. If they don't have it and it's not particularly easily acquired or enhanced, that becomes a deal breaker. And so many times people say, well, they've got all of this or all of that. No, 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 no. No compromises. Not unless you've got a darn good reason. Or in some cases, if you know that the cabinet they're working with, their direct reports can make up for something they don't have. But boy, that has to be very intentional and known by everybody. So there's lots of thought that goes into this. It's not just who I feel good about. You know, show me the meat. Show me the data.
Question for you?
Yes.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, sir. While you're saying all these wonderful things, something came to my mind, and maybe I missed it, or I had to ask the chair, I guess. Do we set the requirements ahead of time, like, say, for the position has to be someone who is a plumber or has a PhD, or these are the conditions with education and experience, must have a master's, must have a, I don't know. Are we going to do that, or do we leave it up to the young man here? And or do we work together to do that? Have we talked about that? Did I miss it?
You're regarding the criteria,
yeah,
that we're searching for?
Yeah.
We would unquestionably be setting that.
Okay.
But in collaboration with the Bryan Group. The Bryan Group is going to be steering the ship on this in regards to the interviews, the process, the procedures. But we're going to be a very integral part of a collaboration to bring the most positive candidate to float. We're going to make sure. There are specific items that are necessary and are not necessary for this position.
Right.
I could defer that to, and I actually am going to defer this, to Acting Chancellor Kiaga. We've had some questions about this, and we've had actually discussions about this. And Acting Chancellor, I don't want to speak on your behalf, but please, what are some of the significant criteria to succeed in this role as you have today?
Before you get there, Mr. Chair, that was really, I'm trying to figure out, have we already done this? Have we set up criteria? Yes. And if so, why hasn't the board been informed about these criteria that we are looking for?
Chair Brooks?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Chair Arascata, to answer your question, we had revised the title in our handbook regarding what this position actually is. And we spent a great deal of time doing that. And I believe that will be part of that process of the approach to seeking candidates is being able to define exactly what this position does and what it doesn't do. And I know that within our own policy, There is some criteria in terms of the way that we get this done, and it would absolutely be done. Mm-hmm. And Chair, chime in with the group that we hire. And so it is collaborative. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I would, as Chair Arascott has stated, there are certainly lanes that we would want to allow a firm to drive in. And we would be passengers in some of that, and perhaps navigating some things, but again, allowing the firm to do the things that they're required to do by our hiring of them.
So, thank you, Chair Arascott and Chair Brooks. My main question really was, and I'm glad we'll be working as a team with them, has the board decided any criteria yet? And if we have, I know Chair Brooks just said that we made some changes and all that stuff. Did I miss it? Was I sleeping through Christmas? Or
that was led by former Regent DeBrava. And I have two people looking at me, Acting Chair Kiaga and Chief of Staff Nicole Juice.
Do you want to go, or you want me to go first? Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record, Dale Arciaga, Acting Chancellor. So, Regent Boylan, to your question, the board approved revisions to the chancellor roles, the job description, which lives in your bylaws. You approved those changes in December. So that's where the leadership profile that you're discussing starts. So you have approved that. Attached to the agenda on this agenda item is the leadership profile, is what the INSHE terminology is that was used in the last chancellor search. It is this committee's job, the committee, not the board, the search committee in consultation with the advisory committee to update this leadership profile. The consultant before you has a process by which his firm does that. It's different from the way INSHE has done it in the past. He is laying out for you his methodology and the science behind attributes and characteristics of a chancellor. So at the end of this process, which is beginning today, the committee will approve an updated leadership profile, not unlike the document here, but unlike it in some ways, because we have chosen a firm with a very different methodology for very specific reasons around leadership and communication, because with due respect, that seems to be where we go off the rails as an institution. And so that's why we're going through this very different process. But you will ultimately have this committee comprised of regents based on advice, based on the consultant's work, update the document that's attached to the agenda.
Thank you, Chancellor Kiaga. That's simple. So that's where I was trying to get. We are going to do it in the future with Dr. Bryan here. All right. Thank you so much.
Ms. Nikolczewski.
That's why I let you go first, Acting Chancellor. He is correct, and I just wanted to call everyone's attention to the supplemental material for the selection criteria, because that is the vehicle that the Bryan Group uses to get your thoughts. And even if you're just looking at page 2 of 6, desired experience, desired accomplishment, desired credentials. So the idea is to have the Regents Committee and the Advisor Committee complete this, give their responses to the Bryan Group, and then he will start to develop materials to bring back for your approval.
Thank you. Regent Brooks.
Thank you, Chair. I was going to bring something up, but I think it would be appropriate to bring it up later, not right now. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Dr. Bryan.
So if we've got page 2 up there. If we go to page 3, just very briefly. On the screen. There we go. One of the challenges, but it's also, this is what really differentiates us, is that if you go out there, and I've done this already in the past week and looked at tons of information on what people want and other search firms listing criteria and so forth, none of which were specific, you can probably find 200 or 300 skills to put in that box, in that, you know, center average thing or that people are looking at. The issue is, how do you sort out those things that are just threshold for everybody, that if everybody does them, it keeps them in the game versus what the superstars are doing. And what the superstars are doing are a small slice off to the right. So what you want to capture in our criteria are superstar stuff, because if they're doing the superstar stuff, then you can forget about all the threshold stuff that just gets them in the game, because that'll take care of itself. Usually on these models, you come out with 10 to 15, 7 to 8 roles that are most critical, 10 to 15 competencies. The leadership styles stay the same because that's a separate research document that we use that has lots of accuracy and predictive validity. But we want to boil it down. So, for example, and I'll use a corporate example here. We were hired a number of years ago by Johnson & Johnson, and you probably know, really big company, got 125 subsidiaries, probably more now, and around the world. And they said, Bill, can you identify for us the supervisor of the future that guarantees competitive advantage for us? And I said, sure. And after going around the world, studying superstars and averages, it came down to, I think it was 14 competencies made the difference. And we defined them at executive level, mid-leader level, and supervisory level. And what did it look like? So there was a ladder. You could see how it progressed. So you don't need to have a ton of these things. You just have to have the right ones. You just have to have the right ones. And that's what another differentiator for us. What's the right stuff? Not all the stuff. The right stuff. That's what makes the difference. And once again, when you look at the superstar traits, those are the things that, or attributes, whatever you want to call them, those are the things that fall in that, in the three columns, fall most of the time in the far right column. Any questions on that? So this is foundational for kind of understanding, you know, where you focus and why. The next thing I'd like to go to is the sample selection performance criteria.
Please.
If we can get it up on the screen. Well, if you've got it on your own laptop, we'll go for
it. We have it on our laptop. CSS is working on it.
Okay. So you can see the description. I've mentioned it many times. Roles, competencies, leadership styles. There's 8 leadership styles. The positive ones are influencer, convener, captain, and coach. And the 4 dysfunctional styles are hammer, cowboy, loner, and friend. And these things, when you see those, they will jump off the page at you. And you'll probably instantly start putting people into those categories who, you know, you knew from the past, which is a form of validation. We don't change the 8 styles per se, but we will change some of the indicators and how you measure it based on what works here. So if you look at the sample, just one role sample, community builder, and it runs over to the other page, A through F. Most of the role samples will have, you know, anywhere from 5 to 7 task indicators. The competencies, for example, in this case, we end up after the fact that linking them and showing you how they're directly linked. If we have to have somebody who's a community builder, what competencies support doing that well? And, for example, political savvy does, and you can see the indicators under political savvy. So this is what we mean by criteria that's measurable. But these aren't your criteria yet. It may have elements of these, but this is what we're working on. This is what we want to get, and it has to capture actual skills, competencies, and culture when we do it. On the second page, it gives a leadership style definition. This is the captain definition. And then you've got a derailleur sample. And careerism is often something you find as people move up the chain that's a problem. But you're selecting these. You're identifying, and I'm helping you, and we're helping you put the right measures on them. So then when we're doing all of the screening, for every screening activity we do, we use the same set of measures. Triangulation from a lot of different points of view. As far as the leadership styles are concerned, an important point that we look at is when that new person walks in the door, which of the four functional styles has priority? If you have an organization that's somewhat in turmoil, they have to kind of recalibrate, reset things, then you want a captain walking in the door. If things are working really smoothly, you can maybe go right to convener, participative, and so forth. But it's context specific, and you also want to know how do you grow that person's or change that person's role over time from a leadership style point of view. And the frequency of the competencies that support the styles as well as the roles. So this is just a taste of what we're going to end up with, but with more of it. And we will validate it along the way. Any questions on the sample?
Does not look to be any. One of the individuals who I haven't reached out to, and this was my miss, Regent Carvalho, do you have any questions?
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. I'm sorry to kind of switch off of this discussion a little bit, but I'm trying to figure out where we are. I realize we're talking about the leadership metrics within item number four, but in my mind, I guess there are still some things on agenda item number three that we hadn't addressed yet. But I'm happy to go back to that after we're done with this discussion.
Thank you, Regent.
But that's all I have right now.
Excellent. We'll definitely go back to that. Anyone else on the search committee as of right now? No. Some of the items in which I've really thought about the roles and responsibilities and what the chancellor does. I know that myself and acting chancellor Kiaga have spoken about this, and I don't want to speak on your behalf, sir. So would you touch upon those five integral parts of being the chancellor? What's necessary? What's not necessary? Some of the items that we've just touched upon, because it held a graping clench on me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dale Urquiaga, and honestly, I know that you and I spoke about this. I don't remember the exact five, so I might get them in a different order or slightly different. But as I've been listening to your search consultant, thinking about the characteristics that you will, and I apologize, sir, if I don't use the same terminology that you do, but as you build out a profile of the things that you might seek, I will tell you how I have experienced this job for the last 7 months. And so the previous speaker has mentioned political savvy. A great deal of this job is about politics. We had the morning session about the chancellor representing the board to the governor and the legislature. The chancellor is also the external face in many ways to other organizations, governmental and nonprofit. And so that is a bucket of work, or one of the hats that the chancellor wears, I think is the consultant's term. Secondly, the leadership style, one of my areas of study is leadership. So I'm not familiar with these exact terms, but where chancellors have run into trouble in the past is in the leadership style. It's one of the reasons that we liked this model. And so I would submit to you that this is it's often called a servant leader job. This is a job of bringing people along. The chancellor has 13 bosses. The chancellor has 8 direct reports in the president's. The chancellor has a cabinet. And yet over those individuals, the chancellor has very limited authority. And so this is a job about bringing folks and constituencies along as a leader, not a hierarchical top-down command and control leadership style. So if I were you, I would look through the characteristics provided by Mr. Bryan in that arena. I would also suggest to you that this is an administrative job. You hear me say all the time, this is a $2 billion enterprise. It's incredibly complex. It's an odd supervisory matrix. The chancellor has cabinet members who are experts in areas of the work and has presidents, but it is it's a complex budget. It's a complex legal environment, and it is a complex organizational matrix. So administrative skills or an administrative point of view, if you are thinking in the way the Mr. Bryan thinks, I think is important. This is also a job largely about policy, helping you make policy, interpreting policy, and then translating that into procedures and guidelines, helping the presidents think through the implementation of policy. And so having some grounding in whether it's how a bill becomes a law or how policy, the policy lever is implemented by the CEO of this organization, distinct from the advisory and legislative role of the board in dictating those policies. And so that body of experience is important. And then if you look at the roles and responsibilities, which I will let you all do on your own, this job is also, at the end of the day, the business is about academics, faculty, and students. And so that is not to say one must have been a faculty member to hold this job, or one must have been a student, although likely the chancellor would have been a student at some point in her or his life. But that is the business. And so at least grounding in a student-focused view and an acknowledgement that there are 15,000 employees and 8,000, I think the number I heard this morning, of whom are faculty, and faculty rights and faculty employment law is different from running a Walmart. And so one ought to know something about that, or at least have the skills and attributes and leadership style that one could quietly listen to the lawyers and listen to the Academic Affairs Council and not tell them, well, I know how to do this because I once ran a Walmart. So I think that is important. So again, that's how I've done this job in 7 months. I bring my own baggage with me. I have my own particular skill set, so I probably lean on certain of those characteristics more than others, but that's how I have experienced the job.
Thank you, Acting Chancellor.
Thank
Regent
you,
Mr. Perkins.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking, Acting Chancellor Urquiaga, the skill sets that are required for a president, can you give me like a versus chancellor versus president? Because some of the skill sets I know overlap, but then there's another level that is necessary for.
For the record, Dale Urquiaga, so never been a president, haven't experienced that job, but as I work with the presidents, they are much closer to the work. They are much closer to the stakeholder constituency groups, pardon me. They must balance faculty student needs in a different way than the chancellor does. The chancellor looks at balancing institutional needs. Presidents must balance that last bucket that I described every single day of their job. That is, I think, a different skill set. Presidents still have complicated administrative structures, they, I think, probably many lead in a way that I would describe. Maybe that's different at an institution than it is a little more hierarchical as an institution than the INCHI system, which is weirdly circular. And when you sit in the middle of the chancellor's chair, in the middle of that big circle, so leadership style might be different for a president. And I guess I'll stop there. Those are, as I interact with the presidents, keep in mind I interact with the presidents at the Council of Presidents, and so we're usually talking about shared responsibilities. But I think that's a fair characterization.
Thank you. Thank you. That helps.
Regent Goodwin.
Thank you for that, Acting Chancellor. It's interesting because actually when I was running, I got asked this question often just because of everything that had surrounded the chancellor prior. And I actually drafted a statement, so I just wanted to put it on the record because I think it just adds to what you said. And what I had drafted was, you know, what do I think the top criteria for a chancellor is? I put someone who is skilled in diplomacy, understands the needs of the system, is able to work with our business community, focus on education innovation, and be a strong advocate for NSHE institutions. So I just wanted to add that to the record because I think it just adds to what our acting chancellor said. I feel like that all encompassed, wow, would we have a great candidate. So thank you.
I didn't have time to type what you were saying, but I 100% agree with that. I was typing feverishly while acting chancellor was talking. So Acting Chancellor Kiyaga, so what you're saying is generally this is an administrative job and diverse and with diverse areas of expertise reporting to it. It requires leadership skills and the ability to manage the board and the presidents as well as the cabinet. The chancellor is a visible person who can hold the system together through stewardship and impressive leadership. Did I put that in a nutshell?
For the record, Dale Urquiaga, both you and Regent Goodman are far more eloquent than I. I probably shouldn't talk at these meetings. I think that's accurate. One thing that I would say, because I don't have notes and I'm not as eloquent as the two of you, the last thing I would say is remember how diverse our system is. And it is diverse in many ways, urban, rural, racial, ethnic, historical to brand new institutions. And having the ability to show up in lots of spaces in a comfortable way and recognize that not everyone has the same experience or has the same needs. And so we shorthand that as diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those are buzzwords today. It is, I think, about being able to show up in different spaces with different constituencies in an authentic way that is welcoming and sets the vision for the future. I do not claim that I do that. I recommend to you that you find someone who has that skill set. I just want to be clear.
Don't minimize yourself. Dr. Bryan, I'll go back to you if we could, please.
Okay. I would like to go to the profile input exercise if there are no other questions. And recognize this is a quick and dirty. We're not going to do it here, but I'm going to walk you through it and explain it and why things are in it. And we're going to set up a method by which you can, in fact, send us your thoughts to get the ball rolling around criteria using this document.
And which supplemental material are you referring to?
Chancellor Leader Profile Input Exercise.
It's a glass one.
Yeah, I'm starting on page one.
Please continue. There we go.
Yeah. Okay, good. So if you just scroll down to exercise one, we've got it there. Okay. There are a lot of things going on in parallel in terms of what we're doing to gather information. This is just one source of information for us to start the criteria building. So the exercise one, straightforward. And we've got some written materials on this as well. But from your perspective, your individual perspective, the system challenges. You can write down as many as you think are critical. then given those challenges that the chancellor is going to have to deal with, what would you see as goals in years one and then in years two and three? And these will be chewed on and followed up on in many cases. And on page two, so this is pretty run-of-the-mill stuff, but important. There's the, given what you've said so far, here's the issues. Here are what you view as goals in the first 3 years. What do they have to walk in the door with in terms of desired experience? But also, you know, you've got to get this just to kind of understand it. But once again, experience does not necessarily translate to competence. What is more important to competence is desired accomplishments. So if we're looking at applications and doing follow-up, what are proven accomplishments, not just, you know, we did this, we did that, and what role did that person have in making those things happen? Because lots of times you'll get a lot of accomplishments that were done by the person's team or somebody that they just signed off on. And then the desired credentials. You know, do they need a PhD? You know, any other licenses, certifications, things like that? You know, some of that would maybe be by your, in terms of bylaws or some of the requirements. Straightforward. Critical contacts, and I will be sharing with you at some point in time something called a contact wheel that shows interfaces and the priority of interfaces with people and groups. People to understand a job look at it in two ways. You know, what are the activities and skills supporting those activities, and what are the priorities there? But the other priorities is when I walk in the door, with whom do I need to build really effective relationships? And get that in a priority sense. So most exercise four, critical contacts. And you may think you're on the same page, but in many cases when you look at the responses to these questions, there will be differences. The next one is where it's something new. And I'm sure you haven't seen it before, because I've never seen it done by anybody else. But it's a role prioritization and competency prioritization. And why is it so detailed in so many items? Well, first of all, most people don't talk in terms of skills. And when you talk about, I've got to be a good politician, I've got to be this, it doesn't give you instantly the level of detail that you need to be able to measure it, for sure. And it doesn't give you, it gives the person in the job priorities. One of the fascinating things I found over and over again in different sectors, usually when you start off a competency research where somebody is paying you to come in and say, you know, give us the nectar of success, Bill. If our super, you know, if we get people who are superstars doing this, we're going to beat the competition and so forth and so on. First step is always just going around and talking to the leaders in the organization. And at multiple levels. And you sit there and you come up with your lists of, oh, they need to wear these hats well, these competencies, don't use this leadership style. But after you've done the research, what is fascinating is that most high leaders, most of the competencies will be influence related. They have to reflect an influence mindset. And you will find that people who think they know what it takes to do the job will have missed anywhere from a half to two-thirds of the competencies required to be successful, and all of them are influence, related to influence. So in this exercise, I'm just trying to pop things out, and like I said before, at the end of the day, when we look at the criteria, they will be related to mindsets, different types of mindsets, with influence, you know, our antenna up around. So the exercise is as follows, and this actually works very well, even though it's really simple. It'll get us down to focusing on those things that are most important, and given the information we've gotten already and your input, will, you know, add the polish and some of the meat that we need along with it. So the first thing you're asked to do is say, hey, take a look at the roles or the hats that somebody must wear well in the chancellor position. And you just go down these and you try to the degree that you can, identify or break them out by A, B, C. Now, most people, as they look at this list, they're going to say, ah, this is terrible because we need this person to do all of these things. But my request is force yourself to say, what are those things that really, really make a difference? And you give it A, B, or C. Now, the tricky part, remember my going back and saying about how people are really good at identifying role makers, role models, top performers, and usually they're pretty good at saying who's really screwing up. Think of three people. We're not going to ask you to share those three people's names, but for yourself, you would write down three people. This is the role model I'm going to keep in mind as I go through this exercise. This is the average person. Occasionally they did a little better, occasionally a little worse, but they're not a superstar. And when you think about this, we're saying think about chancellors, but if you can't think of a chancellor that fits, we need one for each of the roles. Role model, competent, and needs improvement. Then think of a higher ed senior leader to think about and use that, and that'll work okay. So you've got role model, competent, needs improvement. They're not, just not doing that great a job for whatever reason. We don't care the reason. We're not going to be asking you the name or the reason. And then as you go down, what you do is you put a check mark or an X, and we're going to set this up online for you anyway, is you say administrator. And you're going to have to give your own definition at this point in time. Did the role model person on a regular basis demonstrate that administrator hat well when needed? And if yes, you put a check. If no, you leave it blank. And you do that with all of the roles. And so at the end of the day, what we get that we can work with is we get which of the roles people feel as though were most critical. Because what we're really looking at, remember the Venn diagram? We don't want all of those common things in the middle. So what we're looking at in particular are those particular roles where there's lots of checks for the role model and much less for the competent. We know you're going to get a ton more checks, in both role model and competent that needs improvement. But it's the differentiators again. It's those things that really make a difference. Once we have those other data that we're collecting, we can start putting measures on. And then you're asked to use the same three people, do the same three people for the list of competencies. And we will, at the end of the day, relate the competencies to role support and so forth. And we once again, we will start putting indicators, measurable things along the way. But this usually generates, you can do it very quickly, and it generates very interesting information that will be shared back with you. And then help us starting focusing on what's most important. And obviously, we're going to be looking at things, I would hope, for our acting chancellor that you would see things on here that, ring a bell. And by giving lots of things, because people don't usually think in these terms, it gets you, forces you to think a little bit more about the job.
Fantastic. So what I'm going to do here, Dr. Bryan, is I'm going to ask the regents and advisory committee to complete the Bryan Group selection criteria exercises in the supplemental material. And you said you're going to be able to provide us this list?
Yeah, we'll provide a link online. We'll next couple days, well, Monday or Tuesday, we should have it wrapped up for you. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I know I've flown through this quickly. There's only one last exercise. It asks for other information, but it's also asking you to think about failure factors. As you look back over the history of the organization, people who have not done as good a job as you would like, particularly in the chancellor position, or if you don't have, you need another model for a higher level senior leader. just think about it. You know, what were they? And all we need now is the title, and we will flesh out the indicators. How do we measure that? And we'll vet that information with you.
Excellent. A couple of the items that have come across my desk are the timeline in this. And Acting Chancellor and I have spoken about this as Chair Brooks and yourself. And that's an item that we're going to proceed with probably most likely at the next meeting. We're going to have a breakdown of the timeline in which we'll be appointing the new chancellor. It's not going to be something that we can go ahead and present right now at this point, primarily because this is the first time this information has been introduced to any of us. And for all of us to fully grasp and absorb the, hopefully not the complexity of this process, but to start the process in a smart, pragmatic approach in which we're going to find the appropriate individual to lead our system. So right now a time frame is not going to be able to be provided, but it will be in the very near future. And with that, I'm going to open up for some questions from any of the advisor members. Please, Dr. Mina.
Thank you, Chair. A point of clarification.
Yeah.
When we're rating these roles and competencies, do you want us to do it three times for three different people that we experienced in the job?
Yes, but usually people will do it at one time. So as you look at administrator, you say my top chancellor, yes. You know, the competent, yes, and the needs improvement, no. So you are doing three evaluations as you look at the one role or the one competency. And all you're saying is that they demonstrate it well when needed, and you're just putting a check if yes. You may find in some cases you've got three checks because all of them did it well. In some cases you may find none. And by the way, if there are if there are a few that have none, we have to come back and ask the question, should they be? You know, should they, even your top performer, if we weren't doing it, do we need to take a closer look at whether that should be a requirement?
So you might have three X's in the RM box?
No, as you look at a particular, let's say it's the administrator, you're only going to give one score. Did the role model person you're thinking of demonstrate it well when necessary or not?
Okay, so I'm just answering about one person at that point.
Right, and then you go and say, did my competent person demonstrate it when necessary? Did my needs improvement person demonstrate it?
All right, I understand now. Thank you very much for the clarification.
Thank you, Dr. Mina. Yes, Regent Boylan.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. It's great stuff. But this is too much homework for me, huh? I left school for all this homework. Can we just convince him? I'm getting used to him, and by him I mean Mr. Kiyawa. We won't have to do all this homework. I mean, we keep the contract, sure. But, I think we can convince him, buy him a coffee or something like that, and just keep him on.
And with that, I'll go to Regent Goodwin.
I was not clearing my throat for that reason. Thank you, Chair. I did want to say something. I just wanted to put this on the record. I have to admit, I was a little skeptical at first because you don't have any background in higher education searches. But I will say, with all of the work that I've done with my addiction center that I work with, I've learned so much about behavior and I think that this is maybe a really wonderful way to proceed. So I just wanted to let you know that I think that background is going to be very advantageous for us moving forward. I just think it's important that we attract hopefully the best candidates. Yeah. And I look forward to working with you.
Well, I appreciate that. Nine times out of 10, we don't get searches, but we come in second. We really love this, what you're saying and everything, but you haven't done 1,000 searches. And it's really hard for people to appreciate it until I get into it. Yeah. So thank you.
Regent Perkins?
Just for clarification, is this a national search or an in-state search?
This is an in-state search. I'm going to go to Rena. Regent Downs, do you have any questions, sir?
No, thank you very much.
Excellent. Any questions from anyone in the room? Dr. Bryan, we have our work cut out for us.
We certainly do.
We are going to be in continuous communication, and I know that we all look forward to the leader profile input exercise. When you have that up and running, please provide it to us in order for us to properly disseminate it to all. And Regent Del Carlo, question, please.
Thank you, Chair. I missed the first part of the meeting, but where did we say or decide it's going to be just a Nevada search? I thought we were doing a Nevada and a national search. Who made that decision?
We made that as a board at a recent meeting, correct?
Yeah.
Chair Brooks?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Escada. Just for clarification, the board did have robust discussion about what this would look like. And I believe it was in December that we voted in a manner that we would begin the chancellor search with inside the state of Nevada for some very specific reasons that had to do with wanting to ensure that as we hire the next chancellor, the possibility of somebody coming in who is already familiar with the system and processes that we have to follow to ensure the betterment of higher education in the state of Nevada it exists. In other words, that they would at least be very familiar with that. And then if there are some issues with the search and we needed to cast a wider net, then we would take a look at that at that time. Thank you, Chair.
I'm still on. But, I don't remember that. Was that voted on, Chair? Or I remember reading the profile that you, when you were doing the search for your consultant, saying there'd be preferences for Nevada candidates. But, I mean, Carrie, maybe you can refresh. Is there somebody make a motion and we voted on a board that it was just Nevada?
Chair Brooks?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Escada. Regent Del Carlo, we absolutely did do that, and what we can probably do is find the record of that for you so that you have the information in terms of what this conversation looked like and when it took place.
I would very much appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. Regent Carvalho, did you have any other questions?
I don't either. I appreciate Regent Del Carlo's concern because I don't recall a board discussion about a chancellor search just in the state. As far as I knew, we had a preference for a search consultant in Nevada, but I don't recall, and I would not have voted to say that we would only accept applications from Nevadans for the chancellor itself. Thank you.
Chair Brooks.
Thank you, Chair Arascata. What I would offer to that is it may entirely be possible that we did have a roll call vote and perhaps not everyone was in favor of a statewide search, but the conclusion was that we would have, in fact, a statewide search. Thank you, Chair.
As been previously discussed, we're going to start with Nevada. Nevada search, Nevada candidates, Nevada input. We're Nevada. If we end up failing the search, which I wholeheartedly disagree with because I know that there are quality candidates here in the state of Nevada, I firmly believe, I have great confidence that we will succeed with this search. If or when it is an unsuccessful search, then we'll move on from there.
Sure. I was just going to ask, can those minutes be sent out to us? That specific, what Carolyn, I mean, Regent DeCarlo and Regent
I didn't hear the question.
Can those minutes be sent to us, the ones about the vote
that Regent Del Carlo and Regent Carvalho brought up.
Chair Brooks?
For the record, Byron Brooks, so what I would offer is that I will, and keep in mind, please, the timeline of this was before I was the chair of the board. However, as a regent, I do distinctly remember having this conversation because it
just
was
a hot topic.
Just
asking for the minutes. Not an explanation. I'm just asking for the minutes.
The answer to the question is I'm sure that we can get the minutes with Carrie's support, our chief of staff.
Regent DeCarlo?
Thank you very much. Yes, I would love to see that too, because I do remember reading something that was sent out saying that they preferred a Nevada candidate. And then they talked about the search and they wanted to prefer a Nevada search person. Fine. But they never, I don't ever remember excluding anybody that wasn't in Nevada. So I think this is a very key point. I do want to see where the vote was taken and et cetera, because I don't remember that at all. I too would have never voted just to have Nevada people, because that leaves out 49 other states with experts. And what are we so afraid of, having somebody else from the outside come in? Thank you.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, most people do that when they try to remember my name. But I was going to say, can we ask Council, I was going to say Jimmy again, Martinez, his opinion on this? You were there? Because I'm kind of getting lost also. I don't remember that we voted it would only be Nevada. I know it was discussed. So I'm wondering, Mr. Martinez, would you help
Martinez,
us?
Martinez, for the record, I would wait to review the minutes. I don't recall exactly what happened at this moment.
Right. Thank you, sir.
Chair Brooks.
Regent Brooks. Chair Brooks, for the record. So in confirming with Kerry, our chief of staff, this took place on December 3rd. At that time, Regent Geddes had made a motion to approve commencing a national, regional, in-state, or other search for a permanent chancellor and to hire a search consultant to assist a Regent's Chancellor Search Committee in the performance of the search. Regent Perkins was the second on that. There was discussion. There was a motion to adopt, and I think that is where we could clarify exactly what that motion to adopt was.
Thank you, Chair.
And what was the motion? Out of line here, but what was the motion? Since Kerry has it, Ms.
Byron Brooks, for the record, I think the best thing that we can do, just for the sake of time and clarification, is to have this reviewed and then sent out, and so that we can move forward after that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bryan.
You're welcome. Pleasure being here.
Were there any other questions? Dr. Marchand, up and out, you and our, please.
Thank you. For the record, Eric Marchand, Faculty Senate Chair, University of Nevada, Reno. I understand I'm just a member of the advisory committee, but I would, if it's not too late, strongly encourage the board and the committee to consider a national search. We do national searches for faculty that we hire on campus. We do national searches for leaders of our university. We have aspirational goals. I think there is a tremendous amount of talent in Nevada. I'm honored to live here and to be part of the Nevada system of higher education, but I believe we have not reached our ceiling. And I think, my opinion, it would be short-sighted of us to confine who a future leader could be based on the state of Nevada. And I think that there's a lot of talent out there. So just my opinion and my recommendation. I understand I'm just advisory, but I wanted to throw that out there for consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Marchand. Any other questions, comments? Chair Brooks. Oh, Chair Brooks, yes. One of the items I would like to, under board policy, it was the chair of the board was designated to select the advisory committee or the community individuals that would be having input, including some of the individuals at our table today. Would you expand on that, please? Well,
thank you, Chair. Sure. Because we live in a world of policy with the Board of Regents and ENSHE, I just wanted to offer that there is policy that is written regarding an advisory committee outside of those that are already intact in policy regarding stakeholders for a chancellor search. And what I wanted to do was let the committee know that while that policy is written for the chair to invite advisory committee members, it was done collaboratively with the vice chair of the board and who is also the chair of this committee. And so together we welcomed four advisory committee members, and I really want to acknowledge them because this is a long process and their time is valuable. And so I certainly want to say thank you very much to the four advisory committee members, Mr. Ate Dayden, Dr. Marta Mina, Ms. Caroline McIntosh, and Dr. Mark Johnson. The task that is before you, I don't think that I could understate the magnitude of importance in which we are working collaboratively together to set the tone for what the next chancellor will be stepping into in terms of the makeup of leadership. And we are very appreciative of the knowledge that you bring to this committee to help support some effective measures that we have to take in a hiring process. So I just want to say thank you very much for being here, and thank you for giving us your time and making the commitment to give up your time.
Thank you, Chair Brooks.
Thank you.
And Regent DiCarlo.
Thank you, Chair. I want to thank Dr. Marchant for coming on. I mean, what Mr. Nikolajewski just read from the December from former Regent Getty said national, regional, or state. I really don't remember that vote. Others don't either. Other people have been texting me, and we really need to see that. And this is definitely something that the board would all have a say in. And I totally agree. We need to do a national search. And if the best candidates in Nevada, they'll rise to the top.
Very good point. Thank you, Regent DiCarlo.
Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. Any other questions, comments? Dr. Bryan, we have work cut out for us, sir. Excellent. We're going to be moving on from item four. We're going to go to item five, new business. Any new business from anybody on the ad hoc search committee? Any new business from any other regents? Excellent. Going to move on to item number six, public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko? Is there any public comment in Reno?
No, sir.
And with that, is there any public comment in Las Vegas? And with that, this meeting is adjourned.